Hello and welcome back to The Other Side of Perfect. I hope you're coping as best you can in this current climate, and the following hour gives you a chance to escape and walk away feeling inspired by a very unique story. On today's show, I speak with filmmaker, author, educator, and founder of the Horse Boy Foundation, Rupert Isaacson. A few months ago, I had the pleasure of attending one of Rupert's dressage masterclasses held at Thornton Park Equestrian Centre. And in that moment, I knew there was something very special about his technique and I just had to interview him. When Rupert's son, Rowan, was diagnosed with nonverbal autism, Rupert feared his child would never communicate again. Through a very special moment and the healing power of horses, Rupert and Rowan created a new movement method and a beacon of light for those living with autism. On today's show, we cover a myriad of different topics, from Rupert's alternative upbringing to shamanic training, his work with horses, how the movement method works, and how having a child with autism made him a better man.
From the crypt of the Cathedral of St. Giles came a scream that resounded for miles. Cried the vicar, "Good gracious, has Father Ignatius forgotten the bishop has piles?"
I have to keep that in. Rupert, thanks for taking the time to be on the show, and I really appreciate it because I know you're super busy with your trip in Ireland. When did you arrive?
Two nights ago.
Have you enjoyed it?
Loved it. How can you not love Ireland?
So why were you here?
I came here to do two things. One was to do a demo of dressage work with horses. And the other was to train an equine therapy centre in how to work with autistic kids and horses.
I attended your workshop on Friday evening in Thornton, which I thoroughly enjoyed. You're a fantastic speaker. And I think that your journey was just so enthralling and how you communicate exactly what you do in a way that's very visual and very physical. It gets a crowd to really understand everything in a very simplistic way that's actually quite scientific. And so I had to have you on the podcast.
You're kind, thank you.
I'd love you to talk to our listeners about your background from your childhood and your extensive traveling.
Okay, well, I was born into a colonial family. So my mum is South African, my dad is from Zimbabwe. And although I was born and raised in London, there was this constant flow through of cousins from Africa. And we were going back and forth from Africa. And my house, our house, was a little microcosm of colonial white Africanness, but not everyone in our family was white. My mum's side, who'd been in South Africa since the 1700s, had a lot of cousins who were on the other side of the colour bar, which during the apartheid years meant that they couldn't, by law, socialise or be together when they're in South Africa, but they could in our house in London. So I got a very diverse exposure, not just to culture, but to politics and to really understanding how internal family dynamics can be a microcosm for what's going on a wider social level. Some people in the family were architects of apartheid, like the devil. Other people in the family were in jail fighting against apartheid. I grew up with fists being thrown across the table. Some Irish listeners might be familiar with this kind of upbringing. It goes on in other places too. But what it does is it gives you a broad perspective and you begin to be able to see things from many people's points of view, and that's useful. I then lived in Africa, partly. I became a journalist and lived all over the world doing different things. Lived in India, lived in Canada. Just last 20 years I've been in the States mostly. I fell into human rights work through journalism and my family background, and began to advocate for hunting and gathering tribes in the Kalahari Desert in southern Africa, Bushman tribes, who had been displaced from their ancestral land. And we helped several groups get legal title to their ancestral land, including groups that had been dispossessed by my own family 100 years or more ago. Around that time, I had a kid, and my son Rowan was diagnosed with autism at 2 years old, quite severe, nonverbal, incontinent, unable to control his emotions, massive sensory issues, etc., very dysfunctional. I was also always a horseman. That was always my biggest passion. Although I grew up mostly in London, I had an aunt who lived outside of London who had horses. And she sort of initiated me into the mysteries of all that. And it's an obsession you're born with. And so I was always on the professional end of it. If you grow up without a lot of money and you're good, you quickly end up sort of making your living through it. Because people put horses under your butt that they don't want to ride, basically. And that teaches you how to operate this rather interesting the creature called Equus Caballus. So when my son was diagnosed, it didn't occur to me to try therapeutic riding because I didn't have any background in that. In fact, I thought my son was not safe around horses, so I was not keeping horses at that time. But my son loved to go out in nature, and he, while we were out one day, noticed my neighbor's quarter horse mare, went to her, forged his own relationship with her. I followed this. When I had him up in the saddle with me the first day, he began to speak. And he did this the same week that his speech therapists had given up on him. And I quickly noticed that there was a pattern to when he spoke and when he communicated and the types of movement and rhythm that the horse was in. So I then went to neuroscientists, asked why it was working, got an answer, realized I could replicate this, then realized I could replicate it without horses even. And now we fast forward to today. I run something called the Horse Boy Foundation, and we work on a whole bunch of different fronts. We have an equine therapy program, which is what I'm here in Ireland training. We have a way, I'm going to sneeze, hold on. Whoa.
Bless you.
Just to get my eyeballs back from across the room, please. We have a way of working without the horse, which we do in schools, creating the same types of movement that open up the learning receptors of the brain.
So you're emulating that of what you do, but
correct,
minus the
and
horse.
Now teaching math, science, etc. through all that. And then we have a trauma program. That's the same thing. And we also train people in dressage, because the horses that we work with on our equine side have to be so well trained that that's become an offshoot. So it's a sort of multifaceted thing, really. But it was my family background, I think, that brought me there.
That's what I was going to touch on. Your unconventional childhood perhaps allowed you to be extremely open to various avenues that the average person wouldn't necessarily approach immediately. I think there's kind of this clinical approach a lot of the time to any sort of mental health issue or integrating children with any sort of special need into society. You kind of go with the set structure.
Sure. And I gave that a try. It's just that it didn't work. And so when it didn't work, I had to look for other things. What I did was, because I'm a journalist by trade, what's a journalist's job? A journalist's job is to ask questions and to be curious, right? You got to go find out about stuff. So here's this autism thing in front of me. I've got to find out about it. What is it? What does it even mean? People were using this word, and I'd say, well, tell me what it means. Well, it means it's a condition where... I said, no, tell me what the word means. Nobody could. Well, auto is Greek for the self. Autoism, selfism, locked within the self, the difficulty being the relationship with the exterior world. And I thought, well, okay, if we call ourselves Homo sapiens sapiens, our species, which means the thinking ape, but thinking isn't specific to our species. All animals think. Animals have brains, and yeah, some brains are less complex than other brains, but all animals think. There's nothing special about that. If we have something that marks us out from the other species, it's the larynx, it's the voice, it's language. Yes, a lot of animals vocalize, but they don't have language like we do. We are the storytelling ape. That's why we have this podcast. Right? If we were chimpanzees, we wouldn't do a podcast. We'd have another way of communicating. So when someone doesn't talk, it can make you feel that they are from another species. And so I thought, okay, and they can't tell you, they can't educate you necessarily about how they're feeling and thinking in a way that you can receive the information because you're so used to receiving spoken information. So I thought, who could tell me what to do? Must be someone who understands the condition. Therefore, it must be someone who has the condition. Because anybody who is what we call neurotypical, that's you, that's me, will have an opinion about autism, but they won't experience it from the inside. So I thought, is there a person who has it or started life as severe as my son, incontinent and nonverbal, who's now made it in the neurotypical world? And actually, I found that person. That's Dr. Temple Grandin. And she's a best-selling author, neuroscientist, animal behaviorist, professor of animal sciences at Colorado State University. Started life nonverbal in a corner, rocking, wiping her poo on the walls.
Wow.
And I contacted her and said, can I have an interview? Rather like you with me. She said, sure. I went up to her office in Colorado and I sat in front of her and said, how does my son become you? And she gave me a little roadmap and I followed it. And that's where everything came from.
That's incredible. And do you think that your understanding of the science side has been a huge help in terms of integrating it with alternative methods? Like, I know you went away to Mongolia.
Yeah.
And I want you to talk me through a little bit. One of your books, The Healing Land, very much marries quite well with your journey.
Yeah.
When you went to Mongolia, can you tell me a little bit about the decision to do that?
Yeah, well, what happened is this. I have always accepted that life is 50% rational and 50% irrational. You know, people like to think of themselves as rational beings, but we're not. So many studies on the brain show that we make most of our decisions based on the emotions, and the emotions are tied up in our prefrontal cortex, which is the front part of our brain, which is to do with logic. And so there is no real difference in the part of our brain that deals with logic from the part of our brain that deals with emotion. Most people don't know this. Okay. So logic and emotion are always going to have about 50% of any decision that you make. Whatever you tell yourself, however much you lie to yourself, actually we're not as rational as we think we are. So if you accept that, life can be more interesting because you can explore dual avenues of things from a scientific perspective. So when Temple Grandin gave me the roadmap, I'll tell you what the roadmap was. She said, follow your child physically around because that way you can observe what he gets into. Second thing is follow him emotionally, see what upsets him and see what makes him happy. And you'll notice very quickly that those mostly are sensory things, and eliminate the bad sensory things and maximize the good sensory things. The third thing to do is follow him intellectually. That was interesting because he wasn't displaying a lot of intellectual pursuit. She said, no, it's in the stims. It's in the repetitive behaviors. She said, if he's banging like this, kind of like that, it's probably a math science brain. If it's more exploratory, you're dealing with more of an art storytelling brain. Who but someone on the autistic spectrum with a knowledge of neuroscience could tell you these things? This is fascinating. Okay, so I went home and put it into practice and found she was right. She also said, do your stuff outside in nature as much as possible because there are fewer bad sensory triggers in nature because that's where the human nervous system is pre-programmed to be, and let him move freely. Don't confine him to rooms and tables and chairs if you want that brain to grow. Later, he'll learn how to do that. But in the early stages, it's very important that he has freedom of movement. And I said, can you tell me why? She said, yeah, because most people on the autism spectrum and most people with other types of brain condition are primarily kinesthetic learners, kinetic learners, learning through movement. It doesn't mean that they don't engage their intellect, but they engage their intellect through movement. And actually, so do most people, quite frankly. So when I also noticed that it was in certain rhythms on the horse that my son was the most communicative, I asked her about that because she's also a neuroscientist. She said, what that's probably doing is producing oxytocin, the feel-good and communication hormone in his body. And that's making him want to communicate, but it's also switching off the fear center of his brain, which is called the amygdala, which is often overactive in kids with autism.
I felt that coming. Sorry, the wrong way. Proceed.
Okay. So that all made perfect sense. So then I went to other neuroscientists at the University of California and said, is that true? And they said, oh, that's absolutely true. And they looked at what I was doing. And then I consulted with them and another neuroscientist from the Marie Curie Institute in Paris. And they said, ah, that's all true. You're getting this oxytocin effect, but there's something else going on as well. When you balance, it's problem solving. On a horse, you're obviously balancing. So when you move and problem solve, your brain produces a protein. And this protein has an acronym name, BDNF. If anyone's listening, grab a pen and write it down, BDNF. And what it stands for is the B is for brain, the D is for derived, so it's produced by, brain-derived, neurotrophic. Neuro means brain cells. Trophic means growing, growing of brain cells. F is for factor, effect. The brain producing more of its own brain cells. So okay. Your IQ goes up when you move and problem solve. And this was happening. So not only were the kids in a position where they wanted to communicate, because we started doing this with a lot of kids, they were open to learning in a way that they weren't in other situations. And then we realized, oh, well, if that's going on the horse, how could we replicate the same rhythms, which would create the oxytocin and make the fear go away? Because fear cancels out learning, because fear produces a hormone that's the opposite of oxytocin called cortisol, which is like a pair of scissors that cuts the cord momentarily between the instinctive part of your brain, fight, flight, freeze, and the thinking part of your brain. So you act, you don't think. The elephant comes through the wall behind you right now. You don't continue this podcast. You dive to the side. Only when the elephant's gone through the other wall do you resume listening to boring old hippie me. You know, when you feel safe again, you've got no choice in the matter. That's the cortisol at work. If you're flooded with cortisol, a lot of kids on the spectrum are, because they've got overactive amygdalas and they're in bad sensory environments, they can't learn. But actually, the intellect is intact. It's just behind this locked door. So we had stumbled into a way to unlock that door, to get rid of the cortisol, replace it with oxytocin, which also made them want to communicate, flood them with BDNF, making the IQ go up. And there's a couple of other effects too. Makes the same types of movement make the cerebellum produce a series of cells with a very funny name called Purkinje cells, named after a Czech scientist in the 19th century who discovered them. And these brain cells make the different parts of your brain communicate properly, and they also govern social skills. So suddenly the kids start behaving sort of normally. And then finally, anything that engages balance, it also switches on your vestibular system in your inner ear, which is to do with attention, long-term learning. So it's like a perfect, instead of a perfect storm, it's a perfect day. All these factors come together. And we had stumbled into this by chance, but only because I'd sought out mentorship from an autistic scientist. So if I have a strength, it's in knowing what I don't know. And then I'll go and find out who the best mentor is, follow their mentorship, then find out why is that working through other mentors. And then that gives you a framework you can use and give to other people.
You are providing the internal tools for the child to progress naturally and
exactly.
Organically without forcing stimulus. And as a result, there's movements that are difficult to understand. So I'm assuming that all of this subsides slightly when the stimulus is correctly activated
right.
through this process.
What happens is a stimming might not go away, but stress stimming might be replaced with happy stimming. And happy stimming, a stim can then become a skill. So banging then quickly becomes percussion, then quickly becomes tapping on computer keyboards, which then quickly becomes any other rhythmic activity or
so
hand-eye communication.
It.
Absolutely.
Okay.
A repetitive sound becomes singing, which becomes speech, which becomes storytelling. spinning, jumping, you know, becomes all sorts of play skills, which then become martial arts, which then become all sorts of things. So you, instead of looking at these things as deficits and negatives, by turning them a positive sensory and internal brain chemistry environment on, they turn into positives that you then make into bigger positives and bigger positives and bigger. So you're never fighting the autism. You're going with it because you understand the neuroscience and you know how to maximize and optimize the opportunities that show up.
So you're redirecting the narrative.
Correct.
I know in your documentary, which is fantastic, it was quite difficult to get online. We had to sign up for some...
You couldn't do an instant download of Amazon?
No.
You certainly used to be able to.
Yeah. Okay. So I might check that and I'll leave a link in the description of the info. One of the things that I was particularly drawn to, because my background is in Montessori and we would have been open to special needs and Asperger's and things
it's
like that.
Great system.
Two to five age group. So my familiarity was very baseline, as in I'm only seeing these children for a couple of hours a day. But we had a child who was particularly obsessed... terrible word, but stimulated by musical instruments. And he would reel them off to just the most magnificent level. You know, a poster that was on the wall with about 100 different musical instruments, he would just stand and not look at it and reel them off. And one of the situations that caught my eye was your lovely openness to discovering the species separation of the animals, the toy animals that Rowan had. And putting the horse on his own and the animals the way they correctly should be, but he had never been taught that. And so by following your child as opposed to forcing your child, you're observing and encountering something that's almost like a revelation that you can work with. Talk to me about his connection with animals. Obviously, he was drawn to one of the horses and that's how this all came about. But there's something a little bit different in terms of how he connected with animals.
Yeah, and still does. I think that all humans connect with animals. The ones that don't or think that they don't, it's often a lack of exposure when young or some bad experience, you know, that's put them off. But human beings are genetically programmed to be surrounded by animals, whether we're hunting them or whether we're living with them domestically, that humans have never, ever lived separately from animals. So it goes to the core of what it is to be a human being, to be with animals. And humans that don't have much access to animals tend to be quite depressed. For human health, they've measured this. It seems, if you want to optimize your health, one of the many things you need, nature and certain other things, is contact with animals. And oxytocin production inside humans has been measured even with people petting their dog or their cat, and it goes up massive. You will live longer if you have a dog, basically, because oxytocin is very health-giving. Cortisol is not. It's a toxin. And life is stressful, so you get cortisol. Anytime you replace that with oxytocin, it's going to heal your organs, it's going to stop you getting cancer, it's going to do all this. Get yourself a dog, get yourself a cat, you know, get yourself a companion animal, even another human.
And just stroke and pet us regularly.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
No, I have a dog, Storm. She's a mix between a Siberian Husky and a Pomeranian. Uh-huh. So she's a mini Husky, essentially.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Heterochromia, so one blue eye, one brown. Okay. And I swear there's magic inside her. Now, whether that's the magic that she evokes in me, I truly believe that there's beyond healing power, that there's such an appreciation of emotion and how they read us.
Absolutely.
Because they're so in flow. The one thing that I think as humans we stop doing as we're older with stress and cortisol and increased kind of demands with society is forget how to enjoy flow and be present. And that's why there's so many mindful apps and there's therapy and there's people trying to seek. But animals is this
animals
free.
Bring you straight back to that. Absolutely. But also, human facial expression is ridiculously complex. We have, you know, 8 bazillion muscles in our faces that do all sorts of small, subtle things. And it is a truth that quite a lot of people on the autism spectrum find this overwhelming, at least in their early years. And horses, dogs, cats, have a much more limited range. It's very, very clear what they're thinking. They also have a complete acceptance of you. They don't care if you're tall, short, ugly, this, that, if you make money, you don't make money. You know, the dog that lives with the homeless guy is just as happy, if not more happy, than the dog that lives with the billionaire because he actually spends more time with his human. Mm-hmm. They accept us exactly as we are. And they also give us a lot of sensory input. They hug on us, they love on us, especially mammals, because all mammals have this mammalian caregiving system for affection to produce oxytocin, to produce bonding, which is good for the species.
And this is within themselves.
Yeah. It's in every mammal from a mouse to a blue whale. And we're somewhere in between. It's called the mammalian caregiving system. Animals will also advocate. So most mature adult mammals will advocate for the young of other ones if they don't eat them. It can go the other way too, in a really interesting way. We've all observed this. We've all observed a horse or a dog that becomes sort of protective towards a young child or allows a young child to pull on their ears or stick a fork in them or something, which they would never allow an adult to do. They recognize this sort of caregiving thing. So you put all those things together and you put an autistic kid with these sorts of social mammals, and you're generally going to get a very good response.
I suppose the progress from Mongolia and your trip there, you did a lot of shaman and healing work.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to know a little bit more
about that. All right, so why did we go to Mongolia and see these shamans? Because we've been talking about neuroscience.
It's such a normal thing to do.
Yeah, well.
Standard holiday. You know, feck Portugal for 2 weeks. Who needs sunshine?
Well, there's actually quite a lot of sunshine in Mongolia, but hey. Remember, life is 50% rational, 50% irrational. And remember that I grew up with an African background. And remember that I lived and worked with hunting and gathering tribes. So I probably saw my first shamanic ceremony when I was 7, I think, on my grandfather's farm in Zimbabwe. And it happened all the time. Witch doctors would show up. And my grandfather was a good old racist, which meant that he didn't have a clinic for his farm workers. And he had about 1,500 farm workers in various farms dotted around the country. So when they got sick and needed to get better, if there was access to Western medicine, they'd use it. And if there wasn't, they'd fall back on their traditional practices. And you noticed as a kid that people got sick and got better. By the time I was working with hunting and gathering tribes, I saw some really mind-blowing things. I saw cancers effectively being pulled out of people's bodies. I saw rheumatoid arthritis being sort of drained from people's legs, this sort of thing during ceremonies, and going, wow. And also a really evolved use of plants for pharmacology. And I was constantly running into guys from pharmaceutical companies out in the bush going round these tribes saying, what do you use for menstrual cramps? What do you use for headaches? What do you use for this? What do you use for that? And they would then go away and patent these things.
Integrating the witch doctrine.
Correct. No, they know very well that these guys are effective. And they harness the plants where they can, to the degree that my little human rights organization helped one group of Bushmen win a case against Pfizer. That's the same people that give you erections with Viagra, who had put a patent on a plant called Hoodia, which is an appetite suppressant, which the Bushmen use when they go for long hunts. And they were marketing it as a diet pill.
So I'm familiar with it.
Right. We actually helped that Bushman tribe sue so that they could get a royalty. Because this pharmaceutical company slapped a patent on the plant that they've been using for 2 million years. Yeah, crazy. So it's not as irrational as it sounds. Most pharmaceutical products that you know are based on traditional folk medicine. Anyone who's ever taken an aspirin, they don't know what aspirin is. It's willow, for example. Aspirin is willow. Most of the things that we use come from a plant base, and then eventually in a lab they'll synthesize that chemical, but they've originally drawn that chemical from a plant that people have been using for thousands of years.
So the negative, not to take you off track, but the negative side effects that we see through traditional medicine, mm-hmm. is that through the synthesis of adding in kind of manufactured ingredients?
That's a good question. I think there must be an element of that for sure.
Integrating junk, essentially. I mean, it's
Right. I mean, if you're going to use, I think it might not matter if it's a very simple compound like an aspirin, but I think as soon as you get to really complex compounds like, antidepressants, antipsychotics, which have multiple effects on the nervous system and serotonin uptake and blah, blah, blah. Then you start really dicking around with the human metabolism in a way that is going to have potentially volcanic side effects.
St. John's wort is a natural remedy for depression. And yet the marketed version is Prozac, which has...
Which killed more people. Well, more than that, it killed more people. People often don't know this about Prozac. In its drug trials, it killed more people than many, many other drugs. People went off and topped themselves. And they still don't, to this day, know quite why. And then they tweaked it. And then there are always side effects with those things. So I know one friend of mine who took one of the Prozac family of drugs. And he said it really worked, except that he lost all his short-term memory, you know. So clearly there was damage.
It really works, but I can't remember.
Yes, or it really works, but I lost my sex drive. Or it really works, but. And this is doing something over a relatively short period of time. But what if you took that drug for years? Because that's what happens is unfortunately, we're a bit off topic, but let's say you get an infection and you go to your doctor and he gives you an antibiotic. He tells you to take it for 10 days. Or she, and then get off. When you get the antidepressant, there's no weaning.
It's infinite.
Yeah.
As per you needing it.
The assumption is you're going to be on that drug forever. And then what happens is, of course, if it's a serotonin reuptake inhibitor like Prozac, then the what's going to happen is your brain's going to figure out a way around it. And then it won't have the same effect anymore. And then you'll have to try a stronger dose of something else. So it's kind of a bit like doing heroin. Heroin, by the way, was produced by pharmaceutical companies. People don't know this. Bayer produced it in the 1900s. And they called it heroin because they thought it was a hero drug, because it was a morphine drug that they thought, crazy, was not addictive and would replace morphine and laudanum. Of course, it turned out to be massively addictive and killed millions of people around the world. But it was produced by pharmaceutical companies, you know. So enough said about that. The reason to go to shamans then, so why not look for plant medicines and things like that? Because when traditional healers in traditional human environments are not able to get their hands on the plants, because they're not always around, or they're dealing with something that's slightly outside of that, like let's say it's you and your boyfriend and you guys are just fighting so much that everyone else in the village is starting to suffer, we might call a shamanic ceremony around that as much as around somebody with a broken leg or somebody with a cancer or somebody with this.
So it's emotional dealings as well.
Exactly. And the shaman or healer goes into an altered state of consciousness, and in their experience, they go into the spirit world, talk to ancestor spirits, ask for some advice, get a series of instructions, come back, deliver those instructions. And what seems to happen is it seems to work. When we went to Mongolia, we rode from shaman to shaman. Why did we go to Mongolia? Why didn't I go to Africa? Because horses had kicked the whole thing off for us. So I thought, well, where does the horse come from? The source of the horse, if you like. Not Africa, not here, not America, it's Mongolia. So I thought, I had this gut feeling, go to the source, and they had this strong system of shamanism there. Why not? And at the very least, I thought it would be an amazing adventure. And if nothing happens, the worst thing that can happen is nothing. But at least the autism wouldn't have stopped us from having this super awesome adventure as a family together.
And you're using the movement method on your journey.
Correct, which I didn't know the science of by then. This came afterwards, right? Just knew it was working. However, what was really interesting was that on the last day with the final shaman, he said, the autism will gradually lessen its hold in terms of its severe things on your son till he's about 9. And that's, in fact, exactly what happened. But he said the stuff that really drives you crazy, the incontinence, the tantruming, this stuff, will leave like now. And I was skeptical because having been around a lot of shamans before, they aren't usually quite so unequivocal in their prognosis. They're usually a bit vaguer.
And also, just to explain to our listeners, at this stage, you were experiencing pretty severe tantrums.
Oh my God. I mean, it was hours and hours a day and incontinence on a level, you know, when your kid is basically effectively 6 years old, he's just, you know, they're pooing like a grown man, you know, it's constant. It's, yeah, up to your elbows and shit, you know, it's just, you're exhausted, you're, you know. So I was like, well, that sounds great. But even with this background with shamanism, I haven't got a woo-woo bone in my body. I've just had a different experience, perhaps, to your
not
average
entirely
listener.
Convinced right, with the instantaneous
right. So,
promise.
No, I'm not credulous in that way. I go on what I observe. I just had observed it working. All right, so we rode down that mountain. 27 hours after we left, Ghost, that was the name of the shaman, after we left his camp, he was the reindeer herder, lived above the tree line at 12,000 feet in the mountains bordering Siberia. Very remote. Rowan did his first intentional poo and cleaned himself. It was like watching England win the World Cup. I mean, which will never happen, you know, but better. And there was this, oh my God, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. And we counted 6, I think, tantrums of any note in the 2 weeks that it took us to get from that mountain to back to our home in Texas.
Versus up to 4 hours a day prior to.
Yeah, God knows how many a day, 6, 12, you know. And it sort of went away. So it was right. When I made the movie, we happened to catch those moments on camera. And I wanted to make that documentary because I knew I was going to write a book because I'm a book writer. But I thought, you know, if we go away to this place that the reader will never go to and have these experiences that the reader can never verify, and then I ask the reader to just believe me, it's more than a reader. There'll be other autism parents there in a desperate situation. You want to have some sort of documentary record that this actually happened. So that's why we took cameras. But the odds of having the camera on at that particular moment, pointed at that particular time, are still relatively slim because unless you have the cameras rolling for 24 hours a day, by the way, you're outside, the kid could be anywhere.
Can't plan and foresee it.
No, it's not something you can choreograph. And so then we thought, well, then if we make a documentary, then at least there's a record. And so that was really our motivation. When I had a private screening for my family of this documentary, my uncle was there. My uncle was the head of pathology at University College Hospital in London. So scientific background, I would say. And not always a nice man. And very not afraid to take a big shit all over you if he thought you were full of shit. And I expected him to do that. So at the end of the movie, I went up to him and I opened an imaginary umbrella and I held it over my head, said,
"Ready?
Surf's up, do your worst, you know, take a shit." And he said, "Actually, Rupert, this time I'm not going to take a shit." And I said, "Well, why? You always do." And he said, "Well, because you've hit on a couple of interesting things here." And I said, "Well, what are they?" And he said, "Well, one, remember, this is almost 15 years ago. He said, well, actually 10 years ago now. He said, you're saying that autism isn't necessarily the end of the world and can actually even be a good thing. That's interesting. The other thing that you're saying is you've pointed out an interesting potential use of the placebo effect. And I said, oh, tell me more. And he said, well, most people misunderstand the placebo effect. He said, they think that something doesn't work because it's the placebo effect, which means they fundamentally misunderstand what it is. He said, modern medicine, Western medicine, relies upon the placebo effect. And I said, well, go on. He came back to 50% rational, 50% irrational. He said, well, you go to the doctor and you get a prescription. That drug that you take only comes on the market if it's gone through a trial. In that trial, it has to make more people better than the placebo. The people who get the sugar pill often get better in greater numbers than the people getting the drug, and they have to go back to the drawing board with the drug. And he said, and by the way, the people taking the sugar pill, the placebo, they don't think they get better and die later. They actually get better, and nobody knows why. But clearly there's some activation of the human immune system and emotional system that goes on through suggestion in a way. And he said, it's entirely possible that this form of shamanism sort of activates that. And I thought, well, coming from the head of pathology at University College Hospital, that's interesting. I then dug around a little bit and I found that there were hospitals all over the place using shamans. Johns Hopkins in America's is the equivalent of University College Hospital in the US. It's their primary research hospital, medical research hospital. They have a kid, they have a shaman that comes on the wards of the children's head trauma unit because they found it makes the kids better. And I would love to have been at that board meeting, you know, and they're like, item number 31, the shaman, who, all of those in favor? But these were doctors and scientists, not woo-woo hippies.
I'm linking it back to the release of oxytocin and dopamine and things that we need
and serotonin
and not the removal of cortisol, but I suppose the surpassing of it.
Yeah.
Therapy does something similar because we feel like we're actively getting a handle on things. And so our mind emotionally removes from the right fight or flight, consistent panic mode over to the left, a little bit more rational. I'm trying my best with it. Do you think that it's a similar kind of thing with the placebo effect with this? Because it's going to be greeted with a lot of skepticism, but at the same time, there's proof in the pudding.
Well, here's the thing. You should be skeptical about everything. You should be skeptical about the drugs you're taking. You should be skeptical about your banks. You should be skeptical about your politicians.
Conspiracy theory podcast number two coming.
Yeah. I mean, you should be skeptical about everything. Not just things that are obvious to be skeptical about.
So it's pinch of salt, but openness.
Yeah,
it's kind of
totally.
That balance.
No, I'm a total skeptic. But skepticism isn't the same as cynicism. Cynicism is the coward's way out. That's
it's poo-pooing before we woo-woo it.
Yeah, it's so that you don't even have to try. It's giving up before you begin. So you never have to leave your comfort zone. So that you always deal with the devil you know. And you can always bitch about it in the pub. And
you
play
can
the victim.
Control.
Correct. It gives you a sense of control. But really, it's just because you're a chicken. Cynics are chickens. Doesn't mean a certain amount of dry humor cynicism isn't fun. But real cynicism is just a sort of excuse for inaction. Skepticism is simply curiosity at work. It's what it's saying is prove it. And if someone says, I can't, but this has been my experience, then you say, okay, let's see how many other people out there have had a similar experience. Oh, look, there's about 8 million of them. Okay, then is there a pattern to this? It seems that this pattern is there. Can we hire these scientists to come in and do a study? Now let's do another study and another. And that's good science, because good science always comes from observation. And I think we would have all been pretty skeptical 100 years ago that people would have gone to the moon. And I think we'd have been pretty skeptical that we'd have had
tin can in the sky.
The internet. I think we'd have been pretty skeptical about a lot of things that we have now. And I think we're skeptical now about a lot of things that we'll have in the future. But that skepticism is a necessary part of curiosity and discovery. But for everyone saying, nah, never happened this, you know, a bunch of people out there figuring out how to do it. And it's all right to go down a blind alley. You know, a lot of drugs are found that work for one thing are found because they were originally trying to look for another thing, and then they realize, oh, it has this effect on the body. Let's actually move it over here and use it as a drug for malaria or something like that. This happens all the time. So people in science have no problem with this. And what's interesting to me is within horseboy method and movement method, which is our primary things that we do, an awful lot of the people that do it are doctors.
Do you think that you became the parent and the scientist?
So I'm someone who discovers perhaps things that work. Scientists are the people who figure out why they work, and then I take my cue from those scientists. But full disclosure, I'm no scientist.
I think a lot of parents struggling with this diagnosis, which must be like a bomb hitting you when you first hear it. You just cannot prepare.
You're overwhelmed.
For it. Yeah. And there's self-reflection and there's guilt and there's the physical attributes and who's it coming from or what's the... I'm sure there's just a myriad of different things that are hitting your brain in that moment of diagnosis.
It'll fuck you up, yeah. Temporarily.
How did it affect you as a parent?
The same. Because when I was a kid, you know, autism meant, you know, somebody rocked in the corner wiping their poo on the walls. And I'd gone to a school for a while in London, a Waldorf school, a Steiner school that had kids with mental and physical disabilities mixed with quote-unquote normal kids. And there were a couple of quite severely autistic kids in there who did just that. I mean, they'd sit in the corner and masturbate, like in front of you and stuff. And so, oh my God, my kid's autistic. That's what's going to happen to them. And that's that stigma and blah, 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 blah. Then I thought back on those kids and I remembered that they were really good at maths. And then I started thinking, I wonder where they are now. I wonder what happened to them. And then I started thinking, they clearly had strengths, intellectual strengths, that at the time, back in the late 70s, which is when this was, maybe people didn't quite know how to tap into. And that was what led me to, well, who's out there who's made it like that? And that led me to Temple Grandin, who then mentored me, who did it and did it and did it. But yes, it was the going on the quest for that knowledge helped me deal with the baseball bat to the face of being told, your kid will never do this, your kid will never do this, your kid will never do this, your kid will never do this. And being that parent. Oh shit, I'm that parent. Yeah.
Now, how is Rowan and what's it like being a parent of someone who has excelled in the way that you had hoped? What are his strengths? Where have you navigated his new narrative?
Well, I've just switched my phone off for this podcast, but before coming in here, I was texting with him. We were texting the lyrics of Brave, Brave Sir Robin from Monty Python and the Holy Grail in a redneck accent. So it must read as Brave, Brave Sir Robin. Brave, Brave Sir Robin. Brought out from Camelot. And of course, your automatic autocorrect on your phone doesn't want to let you write like that with all these extra
typos. Typo.
So, yeah. So, you know, that's his sense of humor at work. Rowan is currently, we homeschooled him for years, but he's currently at high school. He's about to turn 18. He drives. He lives independently 2 days a week in a house in the country by himself, by his own request to learn how to be independent. He flies back and forth across the Atlantic by himself all the time. I now live in Germany. My ex-wife still lives in Austin. He flies back and forth between us. He is making educational videos on how you should treat autistic kids. How to approach sensory issues, how to approach movement, blah, blah, blah. I mean, he's doing pretty good. And he's totally autistic. And he sees his autism as a great strength. He knows what his strengths are. And he knows what his challenges are. And he's all right with them. Like, he's got no compunction about if he's at an airport having a moment of confusion, going up to one of the staff and saying, sorry, I have autism. I'm having a bit of trouble with blah, blah, blah. Can you help me? Blah, blah, blah. A kind of self-reflection. So intellectually, there's no issues at all. Socially, there's some quirkiness. And then there's all these great strengths, like this really quiet ego. He has almost no ego. He's just the sweetest, most non-judgmental dude. He observes everything. He observes all. aren't my quirks, but he doesn't mind.
So it's acceptance of self, removal of ego, and still perception in terms of what's around him, yeah, without judgment.
Yes, kindness.
The ideal.
It's real kindness. He's the kind of person we'd all actually like to be. And he's certainly the kind of person we all like to be around, because he makes us feel better. Why does he make us feel better? Because he gives us a break from our own ego. So when you're around someone with a very quiet ego, they don't press your mirror neurons. Your mirror neurons press your ego button, your sense of self, which is always comparing yourself to the other person in the room. Am I, beautiful enough, rich enough, tall enough, fit enough, this enough, that enough? And you always find you're coming up short on at least 5 things on that list. And that sends you nuts. Being neurotypical is not a holy grail. Plenty of people chucking themselves off bridges, disappearing down bottles, beating up their wives and kids, da-da-da, every day because of this constant voice in our heads telling us we're shit. Right. And we are not living in a hunter-gatherer tribal situation with a shaman who can wash that dirty psychic laundry for us weekly.
Fantastic service if anyone has one of those available.
We are sitting in traffic trying to live in nuclear families, not tribal, multi-generational things with grandma and granddad and everyone helping out. We're isolated. We're depressed. We're sitting in offices under fluorescent strip lights, looking at computer screens. We're not moving. We're getting fat. We're turning to alcohol and food and sex and money and other things to try to fill these holes. And because we can't fill these holes with them, so then we get more depressed. And being neurotypical is no holy grail. Being around somebody like my son is a bit like being with a shaman. And he's very healing. One of the things you notice when you go into a hunter-gatherer community like that is that the person who is the shaman or the healer almost always exhibits neuropsychiatric symptoms. Could be adult autism, schizophrenia, bipolar, epilepsy. There's usually something like that going on. And there it's regarded as a job qualification. The idea is that you have this sensitivity, this emotional sensitivity through it, which means you already kind of have one foot in the spirit world, and they're targeted for formal training as shamans, because there's a formal training that goes with this at adolescence. So, and they're at the center of the community and regarded as vital to the health of the community, not marginalized from the community, because there's more ways of economic participation in that kind of a culture than in ours. But that's changing with tech. So with tech has come in the sort of flourishing, the revenge of the nerds, of being more open to other types of people, other types of work environment, working from home, the techie brain people. If you're using an app on your phone, you don't care if the bloke who wrote it or the woman who wrote it is in diapers or can go to the toilet. You don't care if they're verbal or nonverbal. You don't care if they sit there going, bleh, bleh, bleh. You just want to use that app. Like, things have changed dramatically in the last 20 years in terms of how people can participate economically. And tech has also brought in all these ways of communication. So someone who's got a stroke, who can only move their eyelid, can write a novel. And somebody who's nonverbal, who's autistic, can express exactly what they want and need and turns out to be very eloquent and can also write a novel or a computer program. So luckily, things have moved on. And I think that if you're lucky, you have somebody like my son in your life to heal you a bit, because he sure as hell heals me.
Do you think that the industrial revolution of social media is going to be the downfall of us as society, where we have to almost revert back to that tribal scenario? Do you think it's too disconnected?
Well, the irony is, of course, social media is an attempt to connect. And what it does is it fulfills a need for connection in us. That's one of the reasons why it's addictive. But because our amygdala, our fear center, is always the most, we always go to that first, because that's how a species survives. You're always scanning for threats. Gossip and the exchange of negative information about who's a threat, where's a threat, is somebody doing something that threatens the social group, da-da-da-da-da-da, that's what gossip is, serves a function in terms of trying to regulating people's dysfunctional behaviors when they're in normal size groups of, say, 150. That's what gossip's function is. But gossip becomes really toxic when you do it behind somebody's back. And or when there's no accountability at all, like when you can't go to that person and say, hey, I heard you said this about me. If you're worried about getting your nose broken about that, you're a bit more circumspect about what you say. Problem with social media is it's completely non-accountable. You can say whatever you like. No one's ever going to come after you. So, of course, people do. And that ironically makes people feel bonded to each other, the exchange of negative information. It's well studied. So it's very bad for your mental health. They're realizing you actually should delete your social media accounts and just use your social media for professional stuff.
They're so personally, are you off social media?
Yeah, I don't use it. We use it for horseboy stuff, but I don't use it at all. And
it's cult-like, isn't it?
It's just, you know, the guys who figured out those algorithms, they know what to throw at you. And the advertisers don't care about your mental health. They just want you to click on their ad. So if more people click on negative things, that's where the advertising goes. And then that's where the money is driven from. And then there's a vicious cycle in terms of people's mental health. People don't click on the positive things as often as they click on the negative things, because our brains are hardwired to respond to potential threats. Once you know that about the way social media is, you can avoid it more easily. But until then, it's super addictive. Will it be the downfall of our society? No, because humans are very resilient and we'll figure out a way to deal with it. We always do. It's such a new thing that right now we're just waking up from the candy fest going, oh my God, I feel a little sick, you know. And there's no question that in many ways it's been a good thing too. There's lots of great things that social media has brought, and the connection of information and that sort of thing. It's just that now we have to grow up and learn how to deal with it. It's like, but it is a bit of a nuclear weapon psychologically for people, yes. And if you're already prone to depression and that sort of thing, it will exacerbate it. For sure. So what do we need? We need more time in nature. We need more actual connection. We need to go back to having dogs, cats, ponies, living with our grandparents, taking walks in the woods, barefoot on the woods, lying on the grass, going to the beach, all the stuff we know is actually good for us, the stuff we do on holidays. And can we make that our living, working environment? Well, hunter-gatherer people do, farming people do, herding people do. Industrial, post-industrial people might or might not do it. And the ones who do it will be happier than the ones who don't. So I guess that's what our society will learn, is that we, as we have more leisure too, and robots take over and all of this stuff, and jobs themselves become less important, but we still need livelihood and we still need purpose and we still need all these things. I think inevitably it all goes back to nature. So why wait? Why not just go take a walk in the woods right now? In fact, switch off this stupid podcast. Right? It's not a stupid podcast. I'm the stupid bit. Switch it off. Tune into the next one, because that probably will be a more interesting person. And go for a walk right now. Or go down to the local dog pound, get yourself a dog, and then get that dog into the woods with you. Yeah, then you'll probably be happier.
Rupert, you've been wonderful. I want to finish on where people can find you. I know that Horseboy Foundation, kinetic learning, therapeutic riding, brain building. Mm-hmm. Where can people access you're providing?
So, well, the first thing is, I told you, get off the web. Now go back on the web.
Go back on the web.
Yeah.
With your dog.
With your dog. Have your dog go on the web for you, because he's got less of an ego. He's less prone to... Okay. And go to this website. It's ntls.co. NTLS.co. That stands for New Trails Learning Systems.co, because we couldn't afford a .com. And in there, you'll find the equine stuff if you're an equine person. You'll find the movement method stuff if you're a teacher, parent, therapist. You'll find a program called Athena, which is if you're a veteran or suffering from trauma. And you'll find a bunch of free stuff about how the brain learns and the neuroscience. You can join the website and do our online courses. Costs about $25 a month. And you can eventually become a trainer in our courses and that sort of thing. Or you can just use our free stuff. It's all fine. There's a bunch of mini courses on there and different behavioral things. And you can mix and match. You can say, well, I'm a teacher, but I'm also a parent. Or I'm a therapeutic riding instructor, but I'm also, you know, a parent or whatever. So use all our stuff, ntls.co. If you want to find people in your hood who are doing and offering the services that we offer, you'll find there's a link saying find a practitioner near you. If you're listening in Ireland, we're sitting in Child Vision right now in Drumcondra, and they're doing it. So contact those people. Terry Brosnan there. If you're in Central Ireland in Cork, you want to contact a man called David Doyle, who runs the Liskinnet Autism Centre. It's actually just in County Limerick, but they're based out of Charleville in Cork, and that's the St. Joseph's Foundation. There's a wonderful lady called Sandra Schmidt, who does our equine stuff over in Bantry. And we've got a number of people beginning. Thornton Park Equestrian Centre in Meath. I think it's Meath, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much.
Contact Maria or Susie.
And you may be coming back to Thornton to
Yeah, we're going to do more. We're doing a lot in Ireland. But, you know, this is a podcast, so people will be listening from all over the world. We work in 28 countries. We have practitioners and mentors in what we do all over the place, including Asia, including the Middle East, and so on and so on. And if you're interested in learning how to do it, even if it's just for your own brain to optimize your own happiness in our movement method, just go to ntls.co, have a little cruise around on there and take from it what you want.
Rupert, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
I really do hope that you enjoyed that interview. I know it's up there with one of my favorite conversations. If you did, as always, please tag and share on social media. Share with a friend or even link in a WhatsApp group, and don't forget to hit that subscribe button. That's a wrap for series 2, sadly cut short due to the current COVID-19 pandemic that we're experiencing. I'd love nothing more than to continue with the guests and interviews that I had lined up, but with the stay-at-home guidelines, sadly I can't travel. However, we'll be back with a bang with series 3. In the meantime, I'll be back with a bonus 4-part series called Quarantine Questions, where I cover the topics that you guys want me to speak about in a solo podcast. I hope that ties you over for now, and we'll be back very soon on the other side of Perfect.